This is Mary Nielsen, and I'm speaking today on the first step of the 12 steps of AA and Al-Anon, empowered through powerlessness. My theme for these whole 10 sessions here at Holden Village is In God's Image, the Process of Becoming. The image of God that I want to focus on is the image of God as a God of love and a God of work. Work energized by love, and love manifested in work. I think of God's work of creation, the delight and joy with which God crafted this beautiful world, and God's ongoing work restoring and preserving the created order, working in and through humans to nurture a troubled world, bringing people into connection through which love is manifested. I've tried this theme, this idea of image of God out on some of my friends before I came, and everybody reacted very negatively to the notion of work, and I think it stems from a kind of negative attitude toward the Protestant work ethic. And yet we all know that what it is that we do, what it is that we are, our strivings are in a day, are very important to us, and that when that work is energized by love, we feel a kind of synergism that is very powerful. The 12 steps is a journey inward that enables and strengthens our journey outward. Through these steps, seekers find a way to tap into the empowering love of God, and their spirits are set free for the tasks of the day, the sacred tasks to which we have been called, the care and feeding, both literal and metaphorical, of ourselves, our own families and communities, and the whole human family, and of course, the earth. We live in a world where the tasks are enormous, in fact, quite overwhelming. Those of us who care, and I suspect that represents all of us here, are continually at risk of burnout. The term itself is interesting. It sets up two images. The first is an image of some flame within us, a passion, an energy source, that has been allowed to burn without new fuel being added, and so it burns out. The flame dies. It is gone, and we are left cold and lifeless, feeling flat and empty. We've forgotten the source of our energy and are desperately in need of spiritual renewal. For some of us, burnout happens this way. We spend so much time in our outward journey and so little time tending to our inner selves that we burn out. But for others of us, the image is quite different. We are burned out. We have let a destructive fire burn within us as our energy source, and it gradually and insidiously burns out our reason. The heat destroys our sense of perspective. The smoke chokes off our love. If this fire is allowed to burn for very many years, we become inside charred and empty pits. Whatever about us that was created in God's image, whatever it was about our work that was good, whatever it was about our relationships that was healthy, is gone. What are these energy sources that can be so destructive? Well, we can be powered and, in fact, driven by the destructive energy of anger, of guilt, of fear, or of some personal need. And these personal needs are the attachments that we're going to be talking about. Those needs might be for success or security, for love or recognition. Can be a variety of personal needs. These energy sources keep us in motion, and in fact, it may appear that we are doing all sorts of good works, but like an uncontrolled fire, they cause great damage. I want to tell you a little bit about my own story. I spent about 10 years of my life as a dynamo of energy. I call those years my fix the world phase. I had friends that used to accuse me of belonging to a cause of the month club. I realize now that the energy source for that time period in my life was a volatile mixture of all four of the sources I just mentioned, anger, guilt, fear, and personal need. Began with Vietnam, moved quickly into the civil rights movement and the Indian movement, then I took on all the starving people of the world, and finally was hit between the eyes by the women's movement. Along the way, I took on the local educational system, the healthcare system, and finally, believe it or not, the Little League. I was fighting to give a friend, a young girl, the right to play. This proved to be the biggest challenge of all because, for one thing, I was dealing locally, and I was dealing with the issue of women's rights, and those issues profoundly touched my own life. The anger that had been energizing me turned to rage. I saw sexism everywhere I turned. I divided the world between the good guys and the bad guys, and of course the good guys were women and the bad guys were men. And I began taking my rage out on the men closest to me who deserved it the least, and then I burned out. It was at that point, in that part of my life, that I had come close to reaching the first step toward spiritual renewal. I knew my life had become unmanageable, and I thought I had admitted my powerlessness, but I still blamed forces outside of myself. I was about as far from living out my creation in the image of God, whose love manifests itself in work and whose work is energized by love, as I could be. But before God could begin rebuilding me, I needed to be hit and hit hard on another front. While I was pouring myself into fixing the world, I was also giving enormous energy and love toward raising a family. Never, never did it occur to me that I couldn't at least do that and do it well. But gradually, inexorably, my family too started spinning out of control. None of my informed, albeit frantic, efforts to get things back into line worked. And finally, after years of hell, my husband and I sat empty in despair at a treatment center trying to accept the fact that we had raised a drug addict. I couldn't make peace in the world. I couldn't stop prejudice and discrimination toward minorities. I couldn't put bread in the mouths of every starving child. I couldn't fix the schools or the healthcare system. I couldn't make the systems and the powers that be see women as equal. And most horrible of all, I couldn't stop my own son from trying to destroy his life. My husband from emotionally withdrawing from the family, our other children from spinning off in their own reactions to the craziness. I felt like an octopus with 8 tentacles all frantically flailing about, trying to do, to fix, to control, to rescue. But everything was out of my reach. I was finally ready, stubborn person that I am, to begin the journey inward, the journey that would lead me to a new energy source. Through our son's addiction, I was introduced to the 12 steps. I watched, almost stunned, to see how this process was able to transform this tough, foul-mouthed, hard, destructive kid into a gentle, caring, fun, wonderfully energized young man. And I was introduced to a world where such miracles are commonplace. I began tentatively listening to some of the principles and concepts and applying them to my life. That was about 12 years ago, I guess. Things got better in our family. We moved. I started graduate school and was able to shelve my inner life for a few years. But God wouldn't leave me alone. Another family crisis threw me back into abject powerlessness, and I finally began a very intentional 12-step walk. As a result of that walk, which several of my church friends joined me on, we've started a program of 12-step groups for spiritual renewal at our church. These groups, which we call Shalom groups, provide a place and a way for people to find a better way to walk, a way to find a way of living out the image of God, to live in such a way that our work is energized by love and love is manifested in our work. I still burn out from time to time. Those are the times when I have given second priority to my own inner flame, usually by cutting my meditation time down because I have too much to do. I forget that even God needed time to rest. The red flags for me are deep exhaustion, resentfulness of people making claims on my time, worry, anger, joylessness, a feeling that I'm muddling through life and not soaring through. And then I stop and I go back to the first step. Let's back up a bit and think again about the image of God presented, a God whose work is energized by love and whose love manifests itself in work. If this is the image of God in which we are created, If this is our potential, if this is what we are meant to be, how do we get from where we are, people often driven by our own angers and fears and guilts and attachments, or people exhausted because we have not tended our love flame, to where we need to go? Because Jesus is our best model, our best image of God, I'm going to look at a number of instances in his life in these the series of lectures in order to answer that question. It seems appropriate as we look at the first step of our spiritual journey to begin with a look at the first step in Jesus' journey after his baptism. And just a moment, you can be looking up Luke 4, and we'll read that in just a minute. And Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit for 40 days in the wilderness, tempted by the devil. And he ate nothing in those days, and when they were ended, he was hungry. The devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become bread." In other words, take care of yourself. You're the most important person around here. Do what you can do to take care of yourself. And Jesus answered him and said, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone." And the devil took him up and showed him all of the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time and said to him, "To you I will give all this authority and their glory, for it has been delivered to me, and I will give it to whom I will. If you will then worship me, it shall be all yours." What Jesus was saying to him, what the devil was saying to Jesus was, in fact, teasing Jesus with the notion that Jesus could, in fact, fix the world. And I think for us that the devil teases us with the notion that we can, in fact, fix the world. And for Jesus, that must have been quite a difficult thing to resist, because it was, after all, what he was there for, what his responsibility was. If Jesus would just acquiesce to the powers of the world, just play the game by their rules, just accept the notion that one must fight fire with fire, violence with violence, evil with evil, greed with greed, then in fact he could fix everything. But Jesus answered him, "It is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." And then the devil took Jesus to Jerusalem and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will give his angels charge of you to guard you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone." This is a new twist that the devil gives to us. The devil says to us the same kind of thing. He says, "Try the religious life. Maybe even try a 12-step group. See if God can help you. Test God. See if God is on your side." Jesus answered him, "It is said, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." And when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time. I would like to quote from a sermon by my husband, Roy Nilsen, on this text. Now, how do you think Jesus shared that story with his disciples? We realize, of course, that he was alone up there, so he must have told the story. You think he said, "Boy, did I ever show the devil that time. I let him know who was boss. I just let him have it." I don't think so. Rather, I believe it more likely that he said something like this: "You know what I discovered? In the presence of the evil one, in the presence of the one who would destroy me, I was powerless." Powerless. Can you imagine the stunned silence that met his words? Jesus, powerless. If he was powerless, what hope did they have in the face of temptation? If Jesus was powerless, what possibility was there of doing battle with the devil? But, you say, that's not what it says. It says something totally different. Does it? I suggest that in the face of temptation here, we find not a Jesus who pulls out all the stops of moral fortitude and wins. We find not a Jesus who, with his own stick-to-itiveness, carries the day. We find not a Jesus who musters up sufficient Jewish endurance to outlast the devil. I suggest that in the face of temptation, we find a Jesus powerless. In the face of the mighty enemy whom Jesus recognizes, we find a Jesus helpless. But powerless and helpless, it becomes possible for Jesus to be filled with the very Spirit of God and speak God's word, that God might win the battle. And if that is true for Jesus, might it be that way for us too? The 12-step answer to that question is yes. We begin empty and powerless. For some of us, that is easy. We have, for whatever reason, gotten the image of ourselves as without power, without purpose, without hope. But for others of us, the fixers, the doers, the controllers, the strong, the mighty, the ones who assume that we can do it, we can manage, we can pull ourselves up, what has to come first is a breaking, an emptying, a death. Death to the illusion that we hold within us the power to even fix ourselves, much less the world. And an awareness that our efforts, efforts energized by anger and guilt, fear or personal need, all of those things that we are attached to both fix self and the world, are probably doing more harm than good. I want to take a quick detour and talk a few minutes about the nature of humanity. I approach this subject, of course, a subject that philosophers, poets, theologians, and scientists have been struggling with since long before the first words were written, with great trepidation. But I also approach it pragmatically. What image of humanity, of self, works to best propel my life forward on constructive energy? I grew up being taught, as probably many of you did, that on the one hand, I was created in God's image. But that image was set aside in favor of the notion that I was by nature sinful and unclean, that there was nothing good that could come out of me, that I was a worm and a wretch. What can one do with such an image of self except live with a debilitating ambivalence? I thought this was universal Christian teaching, and it wasn't until I was well into adulthood and working on my first publishing project, which was an ecumenical study of the Gospel of Luke, that I realized that most Christian groups do not take quite such a dismal view of humanity. Some posit humanity as good and evil as a force from without, Satan, who works to corrupt what is good. Others see humans as partly good and partly bad, that image of the inner angel and devil constantly fighting each other. Freud, as we know, talks about the id, those repressed primal urges that drive us forward into behavior that can sometimes be very destructive. Carl Jung speaks of the shadow self, but says that we are 90% golden, 90% good, 90% in God's image. There is that 10% within us that is working against us, but mostly we are golden. Gerald May, in his book Addiction and Grace, builds on that idea and refers to that 10% as the ongoing, never-ending tendency people have to attach themselves to a substance, an idea, a thing, or a person. For some people, the attachment is to a destructive substance, and it's life-threatening, literally life-threatening, a substance like cocaine, alcohol, heroin, and so on. For all of us, whatever those attachments are, threaten our ability to live life freely and wholly. The attachment can be an attraction attachment or an aversion. In other words, it could be that I spend my time trying to get or to prove something, or trying to avoid or disprove something. All prejudices and phobias, for instance, are aversion addictions. The things that we spend our lives trying to stay away from. It is this destructive process of attachment or addiction going on in all people all the time that robs us of our ability to live freely with our work energized by love and love manifest in our work. Over the years, I have been attached to a number of self-images. Self is responsible. Later on, self is competent. Self is intelligent. Self is formidable. During this stage of my life, it was far more important for me to be respected than to be loved, to be a winner than to be caring. I know now that I had an unhealthy attachment to these images of self, because if anything would happen that would disprove them, I would go into a kind of withdrawal. I would become very angry, resentful. I would just be determined to get out there and do something to get that winning fix. Now, for myself, the addictive pull is to cling to an image of myself as insightful or wise, nurturing, caring, creative. But the difference is that now I recognize the signals that I've become addicted to some self-image, or I have friends who will tell me, and I can process it through the steps. It is important to have a positive self-image, an image of self that we can be through God's help. But the minute we label that self and lock ourselves into some image, we've lost our freedom to grow, to change, to mature, to move as God would have us move. Over the years, I've been addicted to my definition of truth. That definition has changed, but it has always involved knowing who is right and who is wrong, what is good and what is bad. Though the ideas and the cast of characters have changed, the addiction has remained. My need, like Eve's in the garden, to know. Such an addiction meant that I found and stuck with friends and groups who agreed with me, found and stuck with magazines and newspapers that would feed my notions. And it meant that at those times, and they kept happening over and over again, when despite all my denial and rationalizations, I had to face the fact that I had been wrong, or partly wrong, I would go into withdrawal. The need to be right, to know the truth, is as powerful an addiction as the need for a drink or a pill. And it can be equally as destructive on self and on society. For years, I had an adverse addiction to boredom. It was what I feared almost the most, and I would do anything to keep it at bay, jumping from project to project, fearing the end of one project so much that I would piggyback projects so that there would always be something to keep me going, and so on. I have friends who are addicted to food, to alcohol, to risk-taking, to control, to body image, money, security. That's a real big one. To buying things, to status, prestige. Friends who are addicted to poor self-image. That's a very interesting thing to be addicted to. But, of course, if you think poorly of yourself, you don't ever have to do anything. It's good. It helps to cling to that notion of myself as not adequate. Then I never need to take a risk. Some are addicted to good health, some addicted to poor health. And we struggle together, helping each other label the attachment, see it as negative, and turn it over to God, so that we can more and more live out the image of God in which we are created, working at our sacred tasks, energized by love, and having love manifested in our work. What I want you to do now is to take a look at the first step questionnaire, which is on the back of the handout for today, and get together in small groups and talk about the different things in your world that you have tried to change to the point of absolute frustration and exhaustion. We found that that's a good way to figure out what we're addicted to. So look at problems in the world that you have been beating your head against a brick wall to change and how you've been left feeling. And usually when you're trying to do something that you cannot do, you end up feeling angry, impotent, frustrated, down on yourself, furious at the other person, and so on. Then think about the people around you, the ways that you're trying to change them. Now, this is where we get into what we call codependent kinds of behavior. And I know for years I spent probably 95% of my parenting energies trying to fix our oldest son. It just consumed me. I never stopped thinking about, you know, things that I could do, things I could say, places I could get him, places we could put him, that would fix him. And, of course, I ended up being incredibly frustrated, guilty, upset, because I was trying to do something I had no right to do. I was hooked into him in the same way that he was hooked into drugs. And then we all have problems within ourselves. that we keep, you know, you can kind of know those by your New Year's resolutions, right? Things that we have tried to change about ourselves. Maybe it's the way we eat. Maybe it's the way we gossip. Maybe it's our tempers. Maybe it's our mood swings. Whatever those things about ourselves that we have tried and tried and tried to change and ended up feeling just enormously frustrated, we are probably in that area where this is really an unmanageable in our life. It's out of our control. This is first step stuff. So let's take some time then looking at ourselves and talking among ourselves and seeing if we can figure out a few of the issues in our own lives where we really are at that point of powerlessness, that first step.